president. So this has been going on for a very long time. And the Taliban, who were, they were first the friends, they're the Mujahideen, and the U.S. was giving them money and weapons, and they met with Reagan, every president from Carter onward. This is a very long story, and people wringing their, liberals wringing their hands. Oh my God, the Taliban will run Afghanistan. Well, they're Afghans. They, you know, let people in Afghanistan figure it out, and it's not our business who runs that country. But it's not our business who runs any country, frankly.
What do you make of these people who are trying to, you know, use women's rights as a pretext to continue occupying a sovereign country, to stay in Afghanistan and keep the war going?
It's the last refuge of scoundrels. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't see any other way to look at it. Nobody talks about the Afghan women who were killed in drone strikes. Nobody seems to care about that. Nobody seems to, you know, there's amnesia about how, as I just said, these interventions have gotten rid of governments that would be friendlier to women and to their human rights. So that to me is very strange, but it just shows you how untrustworthy liberals are when you're talking about imperialism. This is a no time for this reformist nonsense. This is a time to really be serious and to look at the impact that the United States has around the world, and to question all of it, to question the 800 military bases around the world, to question the defense budget. It's 60% of the discretionary budget in the United States. That's why we don't have the things that we need. So all of it, the right, this perceived right to intervene, the amount of money spent, the U.S. being all over the world, the biggest producer of fossil fuels in the world is the U.S. military. So people who claim to be concerned about climate change, they need to chime in here.
And when you have people in the media, or, you know, just pro-war people in general, imperialists saying that the U.S. is abandoning its allies, what does that mean? What are they referring to exactly?
Well, it's leaving its puppets behind, but that's what they do. We're talking about people who are scoundrels. So no, they don't care if the translators or whomever else helped them during their occupation get left behind. They don't care. They're used, they're chewed up and then spit out. But because Americans believe in exceptionalism and believe their country is so good, and so even in their criticism, it's a kind of criticism that it's more about imagery, frankly. So we can't leave our friends behind. Well, you know, this idea of using the first person when talking about the country, we and us, when we talk about our government, I don't say we or us. I say them or they. But Americans can very easily fall into that we left our allies behind. Well, they are collaborators in the eyes of people there, and that's what happens in wars. That's what happens. But during 20 years, I'm sure there are thousands of Afghans who decided to survive by working with the Americans in some capacity.
Lastly, Margaret, you know, after Vietnam, which was also humiliating, people thought there wouldn't be another war like that. But then the war on terror happened, which is arguably even worse. So, you know, some people are saying the same thing now when they're talking about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Do you think the empire is, in fact, shrinking, as some say, or there's yet worse to come?
Well, there could be. I mean, considering of these people who run our country, there could be something worse coming. You know, the system, the current defense secretary, Mr. Austin, came straight from Raytheon to the Pentagon. I mean, they're not even trying to hide it anymore. There's supposed to be some period of time. You can't go from a defense contractor to a position in the Defense Department. You're supposed to wait a couple of years. And they had this waiver. He went straight from Raytheon to the Pentagon. And that tells you all you need to know about how this all works.
As far as withdrawals go, what we've seen so far only deals with America's uniformed troops. However, if we look back at 2001, the first Americans on the ground in Afghanistan were CIA paramilitaries. And earlier this year, in April of 2021, CIA Director William Burns said that the CIA would actually not be withdrawing, but in fact staying in Afghanistan, as we talked about previously here in the program. CIA Director Burns held a secret meeting recently with the Taliban, as did the head of Britain's MI6. It's also been reported in the media that members of Britain's Special Forces, the Special Air Service, or SAS, have even asked to remain in Afghanistan and potentially establish a covert base on the border with Pakistan. And this would, of course, require the approval of the Taliban, but it's been discussed under the pretext of fighting Daesh, and is something that still remains to be seen, but which does seem to indicate that operations won't come to a full halt, as many have suggested. So as the last U.S. troops and NATO troops depart from Afghanistan, there's definitely reason enough to exercise some caution. In the past, we've seen how George Bush declared mission accomplished barely 2 months after invading Iraq. In 2011, Obama said he was withdrawing from Iraq, and then in 2014, he was sending troops back in. And to this day, Iraq still has U.S. bases occupying it, like Ayn al-Assad and many others. And after Trump murdered Haj Qasem in January 2020, the Iraqi parliament last year voted to expel all foreign troops. This was ignored, and U.S. forces are still occupying the country. The United States has been at war with Syria for the last 10 years. Along with its NATO allies, they've been funding terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda in an attempt to overthrow the Syrian government. According to Syria's oil minister, around 90% of Syria's oil is under U.S. occupation. But if you ask the United States, they say they don't have any boots on the ground. So, I mean, if that's their idea of a counterterrorism mission in Iraq, or limited strikes in Syria, which they have no permission to carry out, or no boots on the ground, when they most certainly have boots on the ground, then what kind of withdrawal are we talking about from Afghanistan? After 9/11, when the U.S. Congress passed the authorization for the use of military force in 2001 to give George Bush permission at home to go and bomb Afghanistan, this AUMF never even specified that it was for Afghanistan or even for Al-Qaeda. It was always abstract on purpose, hence why it has been used since in order to bomb 19 countries. That AUMF is still in place, and if history has taught us anything, it won't be the last that we see of it. Afghanistan is just one part of the war on terror, or as it should rightfully be called, the war of terror. So just because the U.S. is supposedly leaving does not mean it's no longer an imperial power. Iraq is still under occupation. Syria is still under occupation. Palestine is still under occupation. The war on terror, waged at the behest of arms manufacturers and private contractors, is still in motion. The United States is not able to nation build. It is not able to impose democracy. It is not able to conduct counterterrorism missions. There is more terrorism today than there ever was before 2001. The United States and its allies have made the world less safe and more violent so they can make their empire bigger and their corporations richer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
For generals like David Petraeus and Lloyd Austin, there has been no punishment for 20 years of disinformation on Afghanistan and Iraq, says Peter Moss, writer, in an article titled General Failure: How the U.S. Military Lied About the 9/11 Wars. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After 20 years of conducting a disinformation campaign about what was really happening on the ground, not a single U.S. general has faced any punishment. The reverse happened. They were praised for their deceptively upbeat assessments and given more stars. And when they retired with generous military pensions, they landed high-paying jobs on corporate boards, further profiting from their disingenuousness. This disconnect is getting new scrutiny after the collapse of the American campaign in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan and Iraq, several hundred thousand civilians and combatants have perished, including more than 7,000 American troops. Millions of people have become refugees, and trillions of dollars have been wasted. Politicians were responsible for this, pundits were responsible, and so-called experts from think tanks were responsible too. But the generals were closest to these wars and most aware should have been of what was happening. Few were closer or profited more than two in particular. General Lloyd Austin, who is now Secretary of Defense, and General David Petraeus, one of the most lauded military figures of the past 20 years. Since 9/11, U.S. generals have consistently failed to see what was happening before their eyes, or they knew what was happening and lied about it. In congressional testimony, in media interviews, and in speeches to their troops, Austin and other generals who oversaw the 9/11 wars did the opposite of telling the truth. It's crucial to understand what the generals were not saying. Austin, for instance, congratulated the Afghan military for having retaken and re-established security in key areas such as Kunduz. He did not mention that the battle for Kunduz involved a U.S. aircraft attacking a hospital and killing 42 civilians, doctors, nurses, and patients. It was the kind of civilian slaughter that typified U.S. and Afghan military operations, and that doomed the war. Austin, an entire generation of generals, did their best to avoid mentioning these inconvenient details, denying them unless they were confronted with irrefutable evidence, and then doing little in the aftermath to prevent these atrocities from reoccurring. In 2012, the journalist Thomas Ricks, who had spent much of his life covering and studying the U.S. military, wrote a slashing article that described the history of American generals after 9/11 as a tale of ineptitude exacerbated by wholesale lack of accountability. Ricks went on, "Ironically, U.S. generals have grown worse as they have been lionized more and more by society now, reflexively differential to the military. The U.S. had distributed 98,000 sets of body armor to the new Iraqi forces," Petraeus said with enthusiasm, or what he wanted to be understood as enthusiasm. This was largely a fiction. The security forces in question were embryonic, generally ineffectual, and entirely dependent on not just American supplies, but on American troops leading the fight. Petraeus was doing what pretty much every general who served in Iraq and Afghanistan would do, stringing together any data he could find that would masquerade as a narrative of success. The statistics on his PowerPoint were vintage Vietnam. Find big numbers and call them victory. The tactics employed by these U.S.-trained commandos were violently illegal. The cynicism of America's most famous general emerged after the publication of the story, which had the cover headline, "The Salvadorization of Iraq," referring to the dirty war in El Salvador in the 1980s. In 2007, Petraeus was named the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq and became famous for implementing a strategy of counterinsurgency that he portrayed as focusing on protecting civilians and winning their hearts and minds. It was the opposite of what he was hoping to get credit for his British commandos 2 years earlier. The contrast showed the lack of sincerity in their strategy. Yet those strategies had one thing in common. They provided a justification for keeping the war going, offering an illusion of victory on the horizon. The more important truth was that civilian casualties were rising. The casualty figures showed that Afghanistan was growing more unstable and insecure, the exact opposite of what the U.S. strategy was supposed to accomplish. U.S. intelligence assessments also cast doubt on the war's progress. Intelligence analysts in the CIA and the military prepared reports that were far more pessimistic than the pronouncements from commanding generals in the field. But intelligence officials rarely spoke in public, and their reports remain classified.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the most truthful and wise. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. For completion of the program of a genuine religion, an everlasting religion like Islam, there should be someone familiar with all aspects and details of that religion and be able to distinguish between truth and falsehood. Islam needed such a man after the demise of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The most part of whose mission was spent in different conflicts with obstinate enemies. That person had to be someone very truthful, honest, eloquent, and frank so that he could remove any ambiguities and doubts that crop up among people in the absence of the Prophet. This rank, as per the explicit statement of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was allocated to Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first divinely appointed Imam, the commander of the faithful. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam once said, "Every nation has a man who is truthful and esteemed, and the one who is truthful and distinguished from my nation is Ali ibn Abi Talib." So see, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam leaves this world, and all of a sudden, this comprehensive and complete and perfect human being, who was the messenger of Allah, who was the prophet of Allah, he leaves this world. Naturally, there is a vacuum in place now. A vacuum gets created. Every eye is looking for that perfection again. Who do we go for? Of course, somebody who is closer to Prophet than other people around him, closer in all aspects, not just physically, not just in terms of his company with Prophet, no, closer in all terms, in his generosity, in his bravery, in his hikmah, in his wisdom, in his intellect, in his ilm, in his knowledge, all of the positive traits. Somebody who is the closest to the Prophet can potentially fill that vacuum. And that closest was Imam Ali alayhi salam. Well, Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the most truthful and wise, and we said the vacuum that was created after the demise of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, after his departure from this world, from amongst all of his followers, the vacuum was created. Now, who is supposed to fill that vacuum? Well, we said the most truthful and wise. And according to Prophet himself, that most truthful and wise was Imam Ali alayhi salam. Let's talk about truthfulness a little bit so we can learn from Ali alayhi salam and Prophet and try to create this attribute within ourselves. Truthfulness is one of the most basic things for the establishment of mutual social relations. Islam has, therefore, attached more importance to truthfulness as a moral value, and the Holy Quran has mentioned it on various occasions. People trust a man who speaks rightly and truthfully. They hold him in esteem and accept every word of his to be correct. On the other hand, if a man tells lies and talks foolishly and extravagantly, he loses credit in the eyes of people, and Almighty Allah is also displeased with him. If we always talk wisely and are truthful, Allah helps us in doing good and useful things, and in leading a prosperous life. We should always remember that truthfulness is the basis of one's dignity and honor. And where do we learn it from? We learn it from the best, the most truthful, and the most wise, Ali alayhi salam, Prophet Muhammad, and rest of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
France's former health minister Agnès Buzyn has been charged over her handling of the COVID-19 pandemic after investigators at a special court in Paris concluded there were grounds to prosecute her. Agnès Buzyn, a former doctor, resigned as France's health minister in mid-February 2020 at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at Agence France-Presse. The piece is titled France's former health minister charged over handling of COVID crisis. France says former Health Minister Agnès Buzyn has been charged over her handling of the COVID-19 pandemic after investigators at a special court in Paris concluded there were grounds to prosecute her. Agnès Buzyn, a former doctor, resigned as France's Health Minister in mid-February 2020 at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Buzyn has been charged with endangering the lives of others, according to the prosecutor in a special court that deals with ministerial accountability. A second possible offence of failure to stop a disaster was not brought. The former doctor, who will be able to appeal against the charge, attended a hearing at the court on Friday, 10th of September, saying she welcomed an excellent opportunity for me to explain myself and to establish the truth. She said she would not let the action of the government be discredited, or my action as a minister, when we did so much to prepare our country for a global health crisis that is still ongoing. The charges are a blow for French President Emmanuel Macron, whose handling of the health crisis will face scrutiny during election campaigning next year. But the court is also likely to face allegations of judicial overreach. Agnès Buzyn, who resigned from her post in February last year, weeks after the first COVID cases were confirmed in France, has faced criticism and ridicule over her initial statements about the pandemic. She said back in January of 2020 that there was practically no risk of importing COVID-19 from the Chinese city at the origin of the outbreak, Wuhan, and then said the risk of a spread of the coronavirus among the population is very small. Just a month later, as she left the ministry to launch a failed bid to become the mayor of Paris, she claimed that the tsunami has yet to come, in an apparent contradiction of her earlier statements. Agnès Buzyn, a cancer and transplant specialist, later told a parliamentary investigation that she had alerted the president and the then Prime Minister Edouard Philippe to the potential dangers of COVID-19 as early as January of 2020. The special court, called the Court of Justice of the Republic, was created in 1993 to prosecute ministers as a way of improving accountability due to the perceptions that cabinet members were able to escape legal censure for their actions in office. Some critics accuse it of being too slow and too lenient, while defenders of Agnès Buzyn see the investigation as unfair and likely to deter others from entering politics. The former Prime Minister Edouard Philippe and the current Health Minister Olivier Véran are also being investigated. Agnès Buzyn has quit politics and in January of this year joined the cabinet of the World Health Organization's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who has also been under fire for his response to the coronavirus pandemic. Investigators have searched the homes of former Prime Minister Edouard Philippe, as well as the current Health Minister Olivier Véran, the former Health Minister Agnès Buzyn, the former government spokeswoman Sibeth Ndiaye, and the head of France's health authority Jerome Salomon. Jerome Salomon became known as Monsieur Covid for his daily health briefings at the height of the epidemic in March and April of 2020. In France, ministers can only be held accountable for their actions while in office by the Court of Justice of the Republic, the CJR, which is an administrative tribunal. A judicial inquiry was opened in June of 2020 to examine the validity of dozens of complaints, nine of which were passed on to the General Prosecutor, François Molin, for further investigation. The Court of Justice of the Republic, the CJR, opened a formal inquiry headed by François Molin the following month for abstaining from combating a disaster, a charge punishable under Article 223-7 of France's Penal Code. A separate preliminary criminal investigation opened in June of 2020 is being handled by Paris's public prosecutor, Remy Heitz. The criminal investigation is specific and limited and will not look at political or administrative responsibility But whether decision-makers had committed possible criminal offenses, including involuntary homicide or injury and endangering the lives of others, Heitz told journalists. The charge requires proof that those accused decided intentionally not to act in the face of growing COVID-19 emergency. It is an accusation created in 2000 as another form of France's crime of non-assistance to a person in danger, which applies to an immediate failure to act to save someone's life. Investigators must show the actions of the ministers and officials under investigation were willfully absent rather than negligent or mistaken. As well as the provision of face masks and equipment, the inquiry will examine alleged failures to introduce virus protection measures in workplaces and set up sufficient testing to diagnose those contaminated with the coronavirus.
Aperture. Welcome back, everyone. We witness how, cloaked in the shadows from the light of public scrutiny, the Bilderberg Group began to form their own self-serving agendas and wielded their immense power and resources to redesign the world in their vision. Yet, today, this old institution faces a new climate thanks to a new wave of savvy investigative journalists who attempt to peel away the secret history and ongoing influence of this organization. Don't go away, here's the next part.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been deeply involved in the Bilderberg Group, attending dozens of their meetings over the years and acting on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Kissinger faces allegations of war crimes for his involvement in the secret bombing campaign that took place in Cambodia during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. It is alleged that Kissinger willfully engaged in the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in various areas of Cambodia, which led to the destabilization of the country into a civil war, resulting in the rise of the infamous Khmer Rouge. Kissinger is also wanted in several countries for his involvement in supporting the Pinochet regime and the CIA-backed coup that took place in Chile on September 11, 1973. Pinochet, who is now facing a war crimes tribunal, murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende and started a military junta, which resulted in the kidnapping, forced displacement, and torture of thousands of men, women, and children in Chile. Henry Kissinger actively supported these actions that were taking place at that time, which constituted crimes against humanity. Kissinger was also involved in a controversial study in 1974 called National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which the basic thesis called for an active campaign for the depopulation of several less developed countries to stem the risk for civil unrest.
Are you still giving out orders like Memorandum 200, where you said depopulation should be hell? Sir, just a question. I'm not going to go to hell, because Memorandum 200, sir? Memorandum 200? Just asked him a question about Memorandum 200 that he wrote in April 24, 1974. It's an honest question. Okay. Kissinger, Memorandum 200. Depopulation.
We're on topic now. I came here. We give you the access. If you want to burn bridges, you can do that.
I don't want to burn any bridges. Right. I wasn't disrespectful. I wasn't accusatory. It was a serious question.
We're on topic.
Okay. I understand that. So what about the depopulation? I mean, Memorandum 200. Why are you afraid to talk about your depopulation plan?
Why don't you get lost?
Why should I get lost? It's serious.
Sick person.
Sick person. How am I sick? You're the one committing.
I hope it's the beginning of a whole new epoch of greater and greater coverage. At the same time, we're in danger because of their designs on the internet. this could also be the high water mark. It really depends on who stands their ground and what the fight will be. Because, of course, we've just broke last week, people from the European Commission, the Dutch woman Neelie Kroes, wants a mandatory internet ID for Europe. Cybercom was launched only 2 years ago. We saw the Stuxnet virus, admittedly engineered from the U.S. and Israeli and other related allies to use against Iran and so forth. On that pretext, they want to take greater and greater control of the web. The United Nations also trying to have a reach over the web.
The Bilderberg Group include many prominent members of the internet and computing world, including National Security Agency Director and Chief of the United States Cyber Command, General Keith B. Alexander, co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, founder of PayPal and Chief Facebook Investor, Peter Thiel, Executive Chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, Vice President, European Commission, Commissioner for Digital Agenda, Neelie Kroes, Chief Research and Strategy Officer, Microsoft Corporation, Craig J. Mundy, and many others.
More and more, we're seeing the Iron Curtain of media censorship on Bilderberg and the shadow government, shadow elite, pull back. So we're seeing Bilderberg basically try to pass the baton off to younger people right now, a bunch of tech folks, Google, Facebook, and others, hoping that the police state tech grid can protect their criminal activity. They're trying to push a global bank as the solution to all our problems that they created. They're openly trying to push more police state systems. They want to end internet freedom. They want to bring in internet IDs.
The mainstream media is no longer mainstream. The alternative is taking over, and they're trying their damnedest to either restrict or shut down the free internet as we know it right now.
The increase of internet-based media has been closely correlated with the decrease of traditional forms of media, such as newspapers and television, which have been monopolized by members of the Bilderberg Group. In their efforts to maintain the control of information globally, influential figures of the media have been routinely invited to participate in the conferences over the years. Peter Mansbridge of CBC's The National attended the meeting in 2010 and has maintained their strict rules for secrecy ever since. Fellow Canadian Heather Reisman is the CEO of Indigo Books, the largest book supplier in Canada, and she is a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. In 2005, Reisman founded the Hesseg Foundation, which provides grants to former lone soldiers in the Israeli Army to pursue post-secondary education. A lone soldier is an individual who is not from Israel, but chooses to fight in the Israeli military. Other media moguls and organizations that have attended the Bilderberg meetings over the years have included Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, Andrew Knight of News Corporation and The Economist, Ted Turner of Time Warner and CNN, Charlie Rose, Donald Graham of The Washington Post, and Canadian media baron and former Bilderberg Steering Committee member Conrad Black of Hollinger International and the Telegraph newspaper. While all of these powerful media organizations have been present at Bilderberg meetings over the years, there has remained a media blackout all across the board regarding coverage of this group.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering what your opinions were. You talk a little bit about it in the book of the influence of the Bilderberg Group on the mainstream media, or on just the influence.
The individuals are influential, but they don't. Their influence isn't magnified by Bilderberg. I went for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a talking shop, and they're almost always wrong. By the way, they didn't see the end of the Cold War coming. They didn't see the economic crisis coming. They're very interested. interesting meetings. They're very interesting people, but they're not coherent. They aren't a group that meets other than for 3 days a year, and the composition of them changes all the time, except for about 30 of us who are on the steering committee.
And how come?
Don't buy into these conspiracy theories. It's rubbish. All they do is talk to each other. I was on that conference circuit for 20 years, the Trilateral Commission, and I went to all of them. And, look, it was fine while it lasted, but I'm getting too old for that. I'm getting tired.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Okay. But there's no conspiracy in any of them.
No?
But no, there's a bunch of people.
How come you don't ever hear about it in the media? Like, I only read about it in your book.
They don't allow the media.
No.
But in order to encourage people to talk frankly, which you do, you get good, frank sessions. But there's no meeting of the minds particularly.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Fellow Hollinger International Board of Directors member Marie-José Kravis has made significant inroads since being invited to Bilderberg by Conrad Black in 1989. Marie-José is the wife of Bilderberg member Henry Kravis and has been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee for over 22 years. At the trial of the now-defunct media baron Conrad Black, Marie-José Kravis testified against him, providing evidence for the prosecution. Other prominent Canadians who have attended the Bilderberg conferences include former Prime Minister of Canada Lester B. Pearson, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. Many other influential Canadian politicians and business leaders have also attended secret meetings, including former NDP leader Bob Rae, former Liberal Party leaders Stefan Dion and Michael Ignatieff, former Premier of Ontario Mike Harris, former Premier of New Brunswick Bernard Lord, former Premier of British Columbia Gordon Campbell, the Premier of Alberta Alison Redford, the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper Nigel S. Wright, and Power Corporation of Canada CEO Paul Desmarais Sr. In fact, nearly every Canadian Prime Minister back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau has worked for Power Corp.
In 1996, you were at a Bilderberg meeting, and also there was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin.
I don't know if I was at that meeting. I've only been to a few of them, but I Bilderberg and Trilateral are not really think tanks. They're simply individuals who get together who are from business, the political world, the media, others, and discuss ideas, and they influence each other through that.
Shortly after Dan and Steve got back from the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, I decided to file some Access to Information Act requests for information on both Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, and for Nigel S. Wright, who is the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I received two notices. One was for Nigel S. Wright, and it actually revealed very little. They just said that they didn't have any record of him having attended the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, even though he was on the official attendees list. In 2011, the Harper government decided to amend the Access to Information Act and privacy request forms, making it so that anybody that was on the Prime Minister's cabinet was exempt from releasing any personal information. In the case of Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, I did receive actually quite a big disclosure from their Executive Council office in Alberta. 31 pages were disclosed to me just the other day. All sorts of different pages have notices to destroy these emails, do not release this information to the public, do not release any information about your travel itinerary prior to attending the meeting. But a lot of the stuff is redacted. A lot of this information is redacted out. That's cited under different sections of the Privacy Protection Act, which is goes hand in hand with the Access to Information Act request. So any other information that was in there about other people has been redacted out. There's also a page in here that describes the nature of the meetings off the record. Fruitful discussions are enhanced by an atmosphere of mutual trust in which participants can express themselves freely. All discussions are therefore private and off the record. The press is excluded from the meetings. A list of participants will be released to the press on the eve of the conference. There's nothing to hide. If you're doing good things, you don't have anything to hide. There's only something to hide if you don't want people hearing what you're saying. That's the only reason to say it off the record, is that you wouldn't want to be quoted on something that could be damaging to your career.
The very word secrecy is repugnant. in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
How do you feel about secrecy in government?
It's a scary thing. I mean, it's secret, so I don't really know much about it.
I can understand if the secrecy is for national security, but, you know, secrecy and covering up, you know, financial documents and things like that, I think as taxpayers, you know, we have the right to know what's going on in our government.
I think secrecy is pretty inherent in the Canadian government, for sure, and in all government. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish government was completely democratic, which would mean that we would be a part of it, but seeing as, like, we have representatives in this house deciding on issues for us, secrecy kind of just comes with that.
I honestly don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be secret. I don't think anything should be secret. I think if anything needs to be said, it needs to be said in front of the people here that can hear it.
We elect people to govern us in a democratic way. And when those people fall, you know, prey to, you know, individuals that have money or, you know, have leverage on them, it's no different than a dictatorship.
When you have, like, government officials and then you have financiers and, like, heads of, like, banks meeting behind closed doors, that's already against the law.
We have really no idea. And without you guys, we wouldn't be around to know, so.
The more independent media that covers events like this or like anything gives a more unbiased opinion, considering how slanted our current media is.
It doesn't have to be a, you know, massive media tycoon that's controlling what's being said anymore. You know, the average person can do it, right? Which is, I mean, you know, that's an amazing feat. We didn't have that 50 years ago. We didn't have that at all.
It's time to get it out there. We should at least know.
Almost everybody here has a camera. They're all doing live streaming. They're all, you know, interviewing people. I mean, there is just everywhere from, you know, really big names with big websites to just people doing their own little thing. And it's crazy. I mean, everybody has a camera this year.
We live in the time of intelligence, of technology, of instant information. And more these people are realizing that, and they're going to realize that today with the hundreds of people that are surrounding the Marriott Hotel where Bilderberg 2012 is being held.
What do you think about, you know, the independent media's these days' ability to use social media and live streaming at these kinds of events?
It's amazing, and it shows you how many people that are getting aware and politically aware to this.
And everyone's becoming the independent media because of the double-edged sword that is social media. It's also, of course, a spy tool, as everyone knows.
They're worried about us. They're worried about you. They're worried about every person out here with a cell phone that's able to broadcast live or put the video online, where in the decades past it would require an entire news crew, an assignment, tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now we can do it standing out here with a cell phone. So their technology that they're using to bug us, their Orwellian nightmare, Big Brother, or surveillance systems, we're just turning it against them and showing them that we're watching.
What we're seeing here in 2012 represents not just an evolution of social media, of independent media, of the ability of citizen journalists to bring attention to causes that and events that the mainstream media will refuse to cover.
You had thousands and thousands of people watching live stream video. You know, they're interested. People are dying for real information, truth.
We are able to pretty much broadcast to the world, to thousands of people, live, unedited, uncut, as everything's happening. Pretty much just through a cell phone. We're living in amazing times. The technology is advancing.
It's like more than it's a protest. It's almost an independent media summit. You know, there are at least 20 cameras here live streaming, not all like with some central hub. No, 20 independent media outlets, 20 individuals doing separate live streams.
We are making a difference. We are forcing the mainstream media to cover these events, you know, and they are coming kicking and screaming, but they are coming.
If you had an opportunity to maybe say a short little message to the people in that room, the people sitting around that table, what might you say to them?
a hard question.
Tough one, I know. It's a tough one. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It is.
Second. But if I could say anything to the Bilderbergers is, when you do things in darkness, they will come to the light, and they are. We're here just to shine that light. I don't hate you. I'm not going to spend my energy just to negatively go after you, but I will expose you, and I will talk to you, and I will communicate with you with words to try to make you and the world understand that there's a lot more going on than we actually know, and we deserve to know what's happening. We're human beings. We're just as equal as you, and we're all in this world together.
My message to the globalist is the sleeping giant that is humanity is awakening. It's 1776 against their 1984 worldwide. Their system of 1984 against the spirit of liberty. And they will be defeated. And they know it. And they're starting to run scared. And they should be. Because information is power. And the truth is setting us free.
We know who you are, and we're taking our fate back.
We know who you are, and we're going to expose you all the way. So we're not stopping. We're going to be growing in numbers 100 times this in the future. So just wait. Just wait. We're coming.
I'm sure you guys realize, you know, that this is the fate of the planet. You guys are in control. One way or another, people are finding out what's going on.
Life is short. We should live it to the fullest and treat people with respect, honesty, dignity, and compassion. And you could change your life in any moment, any time, and just think about the decisions you're making and how they affect people and how they hurt people, and understand there's real consequences for those decisions that you guys have made, that you guys will have to live with for an eternity, pretty much.
When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you the world. Well, guess what? You've got the world, and we're not going to bow down and worship you. Those filthy deeds that you have done in secret are now being shouted from the housetops. We are on to you.
The reach of the Bilderberg Group extends to every level of the policy apparatus in both the private and public sectors. Its members over the years have been the most influential and powerful individuals in the world. Whether or not they act in concert with each other or simply influence one another through these meetings is beside the point. The decisions made by each of these individuals have a ripple effect for the rest of the world. For every action, there is an equal but opposite reaction. The creation of this new Orwellian technotronic society has spawned a new generation of warrior, information warriors, whose weapons are the very technologies created to enslave them. As the old forms of media slowly die away, this generation is finding new and exciting ways to spread information, open dialogue, and become the true citizen media. The Bilderberg Group and the individuals that attend are now facing a revolutionary adversary, an informed citizenry armed with the right questions and looking for the true answers.
Well, in shining a much-needed light upon these unprecedented levels of secrecy and powerful world players, this new age of citizen media bravely contends that the Bilderberg Group's lobbying powers represent nothing less than a threat to the democratic process. Well, that's it, everyone, for this week. But join me here next time for another documentary. Bye-bye for now.
In the limelight.
This policy of consistently bearing the facts about the impact of the war on Afghanistan must make the pundits at Fox proud. But journalists who care about the principles of the profession should be embarrassed, says Peter Hart, writer, in an article published under the heading, on Fox News, civilians killed by U.S. don't count. Stay tuned for more. U.S. news outlets have reported stories about civilian casualties in Afghanistan with caution, often noting that claims from the Taliban had not been independently verified. But many outlets showed no inclination to be equally careful when evaluating the Pentagon's line on casualties. CNN, for example, ordered reporters to frame reports of civilian death with reminders that the Pentagon has repeatedly stressed that it is trying to minimize such casualties and that the Taliban regime continues to harbor terrorists who are connected to the September 11 attacks that claimed thousands of innocent lives in the U.S. Washington Post. Britt Hume, host of Fox News Channel's special report, wondered whether civilian deaths were getting too much attention, with or without disclaimers. The question I have, said Hume, if civilian casualties are historically by definition a part of a war, really, should they be as big news as they have been? Unquote. The premise that civilian casualties have been big news in the U.S. is dubious. The Fox discussion seemed motivated in part by a study of network news broadcasts done by the Conservative Media Research Center. The group criticized ABC World News Tonight in particular for apparently giving civilian deaths too much airtime, nearly twice as much as NBC Nightly News and almost four times as much as the CBS News Evening. A close look at ABC's reporting, however, turns up only three segments during MRC's three-week study period that were primarily about civilian casualties in Afghanistan. The subject was mentioned in passing a few other times, sometimes to stress the Pentagon's claim that civilians were not being targeted. ABC reporters in general emphasized the difficulties in assessing claims made by the Taliban. Nonetheless, Fox pundit Mara Leeson from National Public Radio seemed to feel that this was too much coverage. She said in response to Hume's question, "No, look, war is about killing people. Civilian casualties are unavoidable." Leeson added that she thought what was missing from television coverage was a message from the U.S. government that says we are trying to minimize them. But the Taliban isn't and is putting themselves among women and children. The Pentagon's assertions that it was avoiding civilian casualties were routinely featured in network newscasts. The uncorroborated claims that the Taliban were employing civilians as human shields were also featured in TV news. Fox commentator and U.S. News and World Report columnist Michael Barron echoed Hume's earlier remarks, saying, "I think the real problem here is that this is poor news judgment on the part of some of these news organizations. Civilian casualties are not, as Mara says, news. The fact is that they accompany wars." Unquote. If journalists shouldn't cover civilian deaths because they are a normal part of war, does that principle apply to all war coverage? Since dropping bombs is also standard procedure in a war, will Fox stop reporting airstrikes? Fox's marketing slogan is "We report, you decide," but these Fox pundits have decided for you that some deaths aren't worth reporting. Then again, being impartial journalists might not be the first order of business. As Hume told the New York Times, "Look, Neutrality as a general principle is an appropriate concept for journalists who are covering institutions of some comparable quality. This is a conflict between the United States and murdering barbarians. With both Fox and CNN trying to marginalize or minimize coverage of civilian deaths in Afghanistan, it's little wonder that self-censorship is taking place